Now we are on to paper two, and Bernadette, you again.
We're staying with significant increases in credit risk, but this time we're going to talk about using the changes in the risk of the default occurring over the next 12 months as an approximation for the lifetime risk of a default occurring. And so, so this is agenda paper two for everybody, so we know where we are. So the submitter notes that in accordance with paragraph B55, 13 and 14 of IFRS 9, changes in the risk of a default occurring over the next 12 months may be a reasonable approximation for changes in the lifetime risk of a default occurring for certain types of financial instruments and in certain circumstances. However, the submitter also notes that this would only be appropriate if circumstances did not indicate that a lifetime assessment was necessary. And the submitter questions the practical application of this guidance, and in order to illustrate the issue, presents an example of an entity that uses a probability of default measure as a means of determining the risk of default occurring. And initially, the entity considers that a 12-month probability of default is a reasonable approximation of the lifetime risk of a default occurring, and then questions the level of annual review that will be required in order to continue using this 12-month assessment. And so there are three approaches put forward by the submitter. And the first is a quantitative approach, and this would require the entity to routinely calculate the lifetime probability of default and compare it with the 12-month probability of default. The second approach is a qualitative approach, which would require the entity to qualitatively assess the circumstances and the changes in circumstances, and only if that assessment indicated that the 12-month probability of default was no longer appropriate would they be required to calculate the lifetime probability of default and compare it to the 12-month probability of default. And then the third option is the recalibration approach. And under this approach, the entity would adjust the 12-month probability of default using a form of top-down approach on an annual basis. And in other words, they would really consider the most crucial main macroeconomic and credit-related factors that would have the greatest impact on the 12-month assessment and estimate the impact of these factors on the lifetime risk of default occurring. And so the submitter asked whether it was intended that a quantitative or qualitative approach was required in order to determine whether circumstances continue to support the use of the 12-month measure, and also whether the recalibration approach might be an alternative way of reviewing that assessment. And so in terms of our analysis, before we go into the detail of it, we just wanted to point out that in the submitter's example, they do use a probability of default measure to assess for the risk of a default occurring. But IFRS 9 doesn't actually require a specific probability of default measure to be used in order to determine changes in credit risk. That is just one example of a measure, and different approaches will be used depending on the different types of entity and the level of sophistication and such like. In terms of our analysis, we firstly noted that paragraph 559 of IFRS 9 fundamentally requires an entity to consider changes in the risk of default occurring over the expected life of the financial instrument, and also that the provisions of paragraph B55, 13 and 14, which allow the use of a 12-month measure, are only should only be used if it is a reasonable approximation of the lifetime risk of default occurring, and as long as circumstances are not indicating that a lifetime assessment would be necessary. And we also noted that was consistent with the discussions in the basis of conclusions, and specifically paragraph BC5179 of IFRS 9. So if then, having initially concluded that a 12-month measure was a reasonable approximation for the lifetime risk of default occurring, an entity subsequently changes its view of the future macroeconomic and credit-related circumstances and factors, and decides that a 12-month measure would no longer be appropriate, then at that point, using that measure wouldn't be permitted. And therefore, at that point, the entity would be required to assess changes in credit risk based on a lifetime measure of the risk of default occurring. And then going back to the details of the submitter's example and the various approaches put forward, and we just wanted to point out two main points. first of all, the standard doesn't require a specific or a particular approach to be taken when making this assessment as to whether the 12-month assessment continues to be appropriate. It does just merely refer to assessing for a change in circumstances. However, whatever approach is taken, the entity should be mindful of the fact that the overarching objective and the overarching aim in paragraph 559 of IFRS 9 is to assess for changes in the risk of default occurring over the expected life. And therefore, whatever measure is chosen, the alternative measure, if the 12-month measure is no longer appropriate, the alternative measure must appropriately capture changes in the lifetime risk of a default occurring. And lastly, as we always do, we're just noting in accordance with IFRS 7 that the entity is in any case required to disclose how that assessment of significant increases in credit risk has been made, and also how forward-looking information, including macroeconomic information, has been incorporated into the termination of expected credit losses. And that's the issue in Agenda Paper 2, so I will hand it over to you for discussion.
So I'll just make a few comments. As noted in the paper, I think we agree that this could be used in limited circumstances for specific products. And what you're trying to do is, you know, use the proxy to capture the change in credit risk. I think in order to use it, you would initially have to do some sort of, you know, obviously some robust work to make sure that you can prove that your change in 12-month credit risk is going to be the same as the lifetime. But in terms of refreshing it on an annual basis, my view is you wouldn't have to do a quantitative analysis all the time to be able to do that. I think it sort of defeats the purpose of using the expedient in the first place. I would view it as sort of almost a combination of the qualitative and the recalibration is the way I looked at it. I think you could map out initially, these are the factors that could potentially cause the two measures to diverge. You would track or monitor against those, and to the extent you hit them, would then maybe need to reassess whether you need to switch from your 12-month to your lifetime. And you know, if you hit those triggers, depending on how much you think you're diverging, if you think the gap is still fairly close, you could use the recalibration method to change your 12-month PD to get back to your approximation of your lifetime PD. And I think that would, save you, kind of get you there on the practical expedient purposes of it. And then I just wanted to note that the paper does talk about this is to use your measure, to track your migration, not your measurement. So I think you need to think about what you're going to use to actually measure if you go into the 12-month or the greater than 12-month, the lifetime category.
Okay, and can I just check one thing? So you said then that if you were mapping these things and that you felt that there'd been too much divergence, so you could no longer use the 12-month approach, then you'd do something along the lines of the calibration approach. Mm-hmm. So that you had an approximation of the lifetime PD. Do you mean by that so that you are able to then take a lifetime-based analysis? So you need to then be satisfied that whatever you've done actually moves you to a lifetime analysis.
I think it would depend on how much, to be honest, you thought it was diverging. I think if you think your lifetime and your 12-month are diverging, you would have to do something, and maybe it's quantitative again, to get you to the pure lifetime view. But if the gap is fairly narrow and you can still make the argument you would stay at 12 months.
I was just checking that you meant that you would either do a 12-month or a lifetime, not something in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Chris?
Yeah, I think I agree with those comments. As a matter of principle, whether it's appropriate to use changes in 12-month PD to assess whether there's significant deterioration in credit risk is a sort of judgment or estimate, and each time you prepare your financial statements, you'll have to preparers will have to satisfy themselves that it's appropriate to continue to apply that judgment or estimate, which does appear to necessitate some sort of review. I'd agree doing a full quantitative analysis doesn't seem to be entirely necessary based on the words in the standard, and rather defeats the object of the guidance. However, I shouldn't overlook quantitative information that you do have available. So, for example, as I said, if things are going into stage two based on this methodology, then presumably you have some information about, we may have information about lifetime PDs for those things that transition, and maybe that helps in some sort of performance of the review. And I guess also one needs to be mindful that, obviously, you originate new exposures each year, and you offer those new exposures are making a new judgment. So you've got to think about, but for those ones, they're the same as ones you originated before, and that should be similar enough to them, the ones you did before in making that analysis. Now, the discussion about the different types of approaches and maybe how we loosely talk about this exercise, I found a little bit confusing, because clearly the objective and underlying requirement of the standard is to look at change, to base the assessment on changes in the lifetime PD. And in some cases we can use changes in the 12-month PD to make that assessment. And I think some of the language in the paper talks about comparing the 12-month PD with the lifetime PD. And that's a sort of apple and oranges comparison, because one is a measure of probability for 12 months, one is a measure of probability for, like an example, for potentially 10 years. So just comparing those two numbers doesn't make any sense. What you're looking at is really changes. Is change in 12-month PD a proxy for changes in the lifetime PD? And obviously the standard has these examples of situations where that wouldn't be, it wouldn't make sense to say that relationship holds. I think those examples are sensible. I think I do find them a bit biased on the one side, because I think they talk about situations where you may have a change in lifetime, underlying, as it were, lifetime credit risk, which is not reflected in the 12-month measure, or changes in the 12-month measure. But I think conversely, you have to think about situations where you might have a big change in the 12-month measure that doesn't actually reflect a significant change in the lifetime PD. And I don't think that's addressed in the guidance, but it seems to be quite an important a factor to take account of. And I think the other thing, what Bernadette said was very clear, I think some of the language in the paper, as I got towards the end of it, always seemed to me saying, well, if you think that it's no longer appropriate to use a 12-month PD, then now you've got to calculate a lifetime PD and use that, which I don't think is obviously not really what the standard requires. The thing is, you've got to find, well, you could base it on the lifetime PD, or you find some other proxy.
You need to find a way to make a lifetime-based assessment, yeah?
Maybe to add, I fully agree. I think, again, we won't find a one-fits-all solution for that. First, I think this topic has a huge complexity. If we want to do this fully in line with the standard, I think we need to come up with some mechanics how this can be made operational. First, I think it's also important to be in the position to explain how the mechanics works internally. So when do we use the 1 year expected loss as a 1 year PD basis? When do we use the lifetime PD basis as a comparison to determine what significant deterioration means? In order to make the whole process robust and manageable. So if it is overcomplicated and sophisticated, no one understands that anymore. And then the question is, how can this then be managed and lived internally? When we approach the whole thing, I would definitely think that we need to first analyze our portfolios. I would expect that in terms of remaining lifetime, we have some, we think about consumer finance, what is the remaining lifetime there in average 2-5 years. Maybe in the corporate space, you have short-term lending, we have mid-term lending in the range of 2-5 years. And then we have the long-term investments with mortgage loans, 10, 15, 20 years. So I think we need to see whether we can somehow segregate the type of portfolios we have in certain, let's say, time buckets for which we then can assign certain mechanics. So maybe just think loud, if we have portfolios with a remaining lifetime of 5 years in average, maybe the one-year PD is good enough as a proxy to determine what significant deterioration means. Maybe we need a lifetime PD of 10 years projected basis, which is maybe then suitable to determine what the significant deterioration for the longer business is. And then secondly, if we have the relative analysis of deterioration in credit quality, I think there will be also definite triggers, hard triggers, which will overlay the significant deterioration. So we might even move clients into stage two because of other positive triggers which are not yet reflected in the rating. So we need to see which trigger kick in first and move the client into stage two. So maybe we have so many hard triggers which we all maybe use in the watch list process to move clients already in stage two, which is not yet reflecting the rating. So, and with that, I think we need to carefully analyze how we can best implement this by the various mechanics which we have in place. I think we need to be quite creative, in a positive sense, to make this operational.
And I don't think that what you're saying there about, for example, segmenting into different maturities and coming up with a different analysis would be contrary to what was intended in the standard. I'm looking at board members here for confirmation, because the whole point was, does it really make a difference to Chris's point if I compare the change and the risk using a 12-month versus a lifetime perspective, and that could be a different conclusion for different types of loans or different segmented maturities. So sounds sensible. George?
So when we've been asked about this, I think people look at the very last phrase in B5513, and it says, unless circumstances indicate that a lifetime assessment is necessary. And I think a lot of them wish you had not added that phrase, so that it was a choice made at the beginning, and then it's kept throughout the life. We don't need to go back and check. And so that's why I think people have asked, well, what do you expect me to do? And the easy answer to me would be the quantitative approach, but it does take a lot of the benefit of this away. But I think there is a misunderstanding that you don't ever have to calculate lifetime PDs. This is only about the trigger. It's not at all about measurement, as I think somebody's already said. They'll say it again.
Yep.
And so you still, unfortunately, have to try and calculate them. And I think a lot of people are skeptical, and I think the words that I heard was spurious accuracy in how good these lifetime PDs are, because the industry as a whole hasn't really embraced this. This is a big change. And so certainly on initial adoption, how good are even bigger banks going to be at calculating this? And in fact, I think people want to try and use this perhaps more on transition, and then perhaps afterwards, because we have lots of things we need to fix and change, that we would then embrace more of the lifetime calculations without having to use this practical expedient. But I think people have taken away, well, I don't need to calculate them if I invoke this. And I think that's just not true. And then if you do invoke it, what is the requirement on an ongoing basis, which I think the methods try to lay out their choices. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I think any of them are great, but it's something that's got to be done on a regular basis after you do it.
Graham.
Oh, actually, sorry, so I withdraw my comment. George drew it out nicely. I was going to point out what Helen had said, was that I think one common misconception we've said, I'm going to withdraw my comment. Here I am talking for 2 minutes. One common misconception we've dealt with is the idea that if 12-month is a proxy for the deterioration, that it might also be a proxy for the measure, and it isn't that. But I think George made that better.
Good to clarify that.
Yeah, okay, good to clarify that then. Right, John?
I would agree with everything that's been said. I think there's been a couple of common misconceptions in the market. The first one is how much analysis one needs to do as to whether this is a reasonable proxy. I think one needs to do an appropriate amount of analysis in the first instance to prove that it's a reasonable proxy. And one cannot just assume that because there may be a bullet payment at the end of the life that it is a reasonable proxy. The level and degree of analysis, whether it's quantitative or qualitative, really depends on what you're looking at, but you need to do an appropriate level of analysis. That's the first principle. And the second principle then is you need to, at each reporting date, see where that analysis brings you. Does it remain a reasonable approximation, or has something changed to indicate that it is not? The level of analysis that you'd need to, I suppose, conduct at each future reporting date probably depends on the type of the loan, the complexity, etc., but it probably is less onerous in terms of the amount of analysis that you would need to do at the initial inception of the loan. I think that's the key principle, is that you do need to have appropriate support to say that this is a proxy at the start, and then you need to have appropriate support to say that it continues to be a proxy as you move through the life of the loan.
Yeah, thank you. I would like to stress another paragraph in this staff paper, and that's about the disclosures. It's of course important to see whether the 12-month PD is a good approximation for the lifetime. But it is also very important for users of financial statements that they can read from the financial statements how companies determine whether there is a significant increase or not, and how they use these approximations. So I'm very happy that staff indicated those disclosure requirements in the papers as well. Thank you.
Thank you. George?
The one paragraph we didn't talk about in the staff paper is in paragraph 5A, where in B5514 it talks about things where this approximation may not be suitable, and it has three conditions. I think what I've noticed is entities either read that and think I can get anything into it, or other entities read it and think I can get almost nothing into it if the life of the product is more than 1 year. And if certainly paragraph B that talks about macroeconomic impacts, if unemployment is a driver of the loss and you think unemployment is going to stay stable throughout 1 year but may increase in the long run, because of issues about productivity or about economic competitiveness, then I can't use it. And so what we've struggled with is finding examples where we think it really is suitable, and examples where beyond bullet loans, because I think we're all clear that bullet loans are an example where it should not work. But there's lots of products that look similar to bullet loans, but do have some payments within 1 year, but then most of the payments are way beyond that. And so if your forecast of unemployment is going to increase in, say, years 3 and 4 of a 5-year product, then I'm not sure it is appropriate to be doing this, because you're not going to get parallel shifts between the 12-month curve and the lifetime curve. But somebody's got to do that analysis and make those assumptions to be able to say, well, the curves don't move the same ways at the same time. So even as a change mechanism, it's not that great.
Okay. So do you think it would be helpful then if we were to emphasize in the summary of the discussion the fact that the foundation for this exception was based on this idea that's in paragraph B5513 about there not being a concentration of risk at a specific point in time, and the point that Chris made, which is that you're trying to provide assurance at the start that the expectation is that changes in the 12-month probability of default would be give you a similar outcome to changes in the lifetime probability of default based on your assessment at inception.
Yeah, and the entities who are embracing it,
that's what it's all about.
Yeah, the entities who are embracing it have done that analysis and have both curves, and they look at what happens when they have stressed it in the past, and they've done all the homework. So they feel much more comfortable. We can apply this on a much wider range of products. But I am surprised by the reaction that I'm not even going to try, because I think we would fail B and C of 5514.
Okay. All right. So what I would suggest that we put emphasize in the summary would be the following. So that at the start you need to do an appropriate level of assessment to give yourself comfort that you have got a situation where changes in the 12-month probability of default are going to give you a reasonable approximation of the outcome of changes in the lifetime probability of default. I think we should make the observation which John made, that sometimes that will be a more or less onerous exercise depending on the product that you're looking at. I think then, because of this reference to changes in circumstances or unless circumstances indicate that that does mean that you do need to be satisfied on an ongoing basis that that continues to be met. But again, I think we could make observations about focusing on particular circumstances that you'd identified up front as a way of doing that. I think we could emphasise York's point about the way that you can look at segregation as a consideration in making this assessment. I think, based on some of the comments you've made, that it would be helpful if we remind people that this is a proxy for how you make the assessment of significant increases in credit risk, but not how you could make a proxy for your lifetime expected credit loss measurement. And we'll emphasise the disclosure again to Ton's point. And actually, staff, I didn't tell you that Ton gave you a public recognition of how good it was you'd mentioned disclosures in all the papers. does that fairly summarise the main points?
Just quickly one question, Helen. The recalibration approach, basically what you were trying to do was actually find out whether the proxies are still working or not, not to determine like IPDs.
Okay, that's the other thing I think we should say, actually, is that if you are no longer satisfied, then you need to move to a measure which captures a lifetime assessment of, and we won't use the PD words, but we'll use the lifetime assessment of changes in risk.
Okay.